It's a...
That nice honking intro music.
It's like a circus, a biblio circus.
Biblio circus here on Books for Breakfast every week here on CFRU. Today we've got a show that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, I'm excited to be excited for you.
For the last long time, I've been sort of dopily slowly weaving my way through a really wonderful, terribly depressing book called The Magnetic North. By Sarah Wheeler, travel and nature writer who circumnavigated the Arctic Circle and documented what she found along the way.
She also hit the Antarctic at a previous point. And yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, in a book called Terra Incognita. She's a neat author, and I'm looking forward to speaking to her at around 8:20. But for now, let's just hear some music here on Books for Breakfast. Books for Breakfast here on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph. And,
that's a great track.
I really like that. That was Andre Williams and the Sadies from the album Night and Day. Andre Williams I've been keeping track of for a while because one of my first soul fascinations was this guy, Nathaniel Mayer, who came back in 2004 when a label just got in touch with him and got him recording stuff again.
So he teamed up with a lot of
like Detroit garage rock guys
and
had a really neat thing going on. And my all-time favorite music interview was with him, and then he passed away of a stroke a few years ago.
Your all-time favorite?
I think so, yeah.
That's
Nathaniel Mayer.
Who was the interviewer?
I mean, me.
You did the interview.
It's the most fun I've had doing an interview with him.
And it's the best interview you've ever heard.
And this guy got his start in the late 50s on a Detroit label called Fortune Records. And it was one of these labels that just was brutal with their artists and just like pretty much completely stole from them.
Damn.
And Andre Williams was in the same cohort and has sort of followed the same arc.
And who's credited with his rediscovery? Did he come back on his own?
I think he was always a bit more there, and I think he had a higher profile to begin with.
Cool.
But now he's teamed up with the Sadies, and oh boy, that sounds good.
The down, you can hear it.
What have you been reading?
Oh man, I had a wild week because this was OLA week, so the Ontario Library Association, and then so that was all day Tuesday. People have heard me kind of wax about this for months, but it's really a highlight for literature because this is the culmination of a year-long school project where about 4,000 kids gather at Harborfront. So that was Tuesday and yesterday, Wednesday. And basically, the kids from all over Ontario get to choose from a complement of about 8 books what their favorite book of the year is. And the Library Association sets the list up in sort of September, October, and ships it out to teachers and gives them teaching material and, you know, curriculum suggestions. And so teachers can take these books into their classroom for the entire year and teach them. The kids all read them as a class or as a couple of classes, and then they all converge, or some of them converge on Harborfront at the end of the year, and they pick the winner. And it's through, like, cheerometer, you know, so you can imagine what happens when 4,000 fans are together cheering. So basically, I'll tell you.
It seemed like you found it very inspiring last year.
Oh, man, I'm inspired. The one image that when I talk about this to people, the one image I sort of offer is, you know, I don't know if you know Harborfront, if you can picture it, but there's at least, you know, a couple football fields worth of AstroTurf at some point, right near the water. So there's like a faux green near the water. So it's pretty. And all over the green, there are these little kids with their noses deep in a book, you know, and just bumping into things, bumping into each other or tripping or bumping into frisbees or little dogs.
I mean, it's like a Kiss concert for kids who read, isn't it? Like, well, people are dressing up as their favorite characters.
Oh, well, actually, Kiss is usually there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
they're actually there. It actually is a Kiss concert. And the books are part of it.
No wonder it goes over so well.
Some costumes, but mostly it's just honest adulation, you know? So the organizers have done a great job. I met Meredith Touching. She's brilliant at the top of this thing. And then our local contact is Cy Van Geest. She's been part of she was a teacher librarian for a long time. And man, they set it up so the kids come out on stage in front of one another. So, you know, at any given time, there might be 800 kids on 800 bums in seats. And these little ones come out carrying these huge banners, right? Kenneth Oppel is the author of...
Wait, did you say it's a Mott the Hoople concert?
Yeah, that's right. As well. Yeah, and that's okay. You wait till you go. You won't mock
next year.
I'm just kidding.
It's a loving kind of mocking.
Yeah. Anyways, the result is, you know, from like 9 till 5, basically, these kids are worshiping books and authors. And there's a couple categories. They level them by age. So, and then they give them fancy names. So the Blue Spruce is basically the young people's reading. So lots of picture books. And there's a great book that won called Giraffe and Bird. And it's just the story of these two little guys who bug each other and how they have to actually kind of work together. Because the bird is one of these birds that pecks nits off the giraffe's neck, you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And then the second category called the Red Maple, that was the one I was sort of there for. Kenneth Oppel, he's a great writer, and he should have won many times over. But his book about a family that brings a chimpanzee home, a scientist dad that brings a chimpanzee home to sort of experiment on, but the chimpanzee becomes part of the family. And this is based on a real historical scientific past truth. And yeah, it was, you know, the kids just go wild for him. And then I went even further. I got to moderate a panel with an author named Sharon Mackay. Did I tell you about this?
I think I've seen that book a few times.
Yeah, it's kind of an ugly book, but it's a wonderful book. It's just poorly designed. I met Anik Press, and I feel okay saying that on the air. I think I could tell them to their face that their cover design is pretty bad. but Sharon Mackay is one of these writers who, God, she really commits to her books. You know, so this book is called Thunder Over Kandahar. That's her newest book. It was in the running for the Red Maple and easily could have won. She spent all of 2009 in Afghanistan researching this. Mm. So just making contacts with local people, basically. And she's the type of person, she's got a big, wonderful personality. Like, she's just nonstop talking, telling stories, kindly invading everyone in this conversation, you know, that kind of thing. And I can imagine her getting into any locked door. So she has all these stories about making it into, say, the mortuary, the soldier's mortuary, or making it into sort of private ceremonies or rituals, and even getting into the back of a combat jeep and ending out in the field in fatigues, you know? Hmm. So she basically tells the story of two young girls. They're in Herat, actually, when they start, but they do make it to Kandahar. And, you know, one has a bit of a Western upbringing. She grew up in London, but she has Afghani parents. And the other one is, like, you know, she grew up in the kind of the barrios, the backyards. And these two girls become friends and weather the war together. And it's pretty gruesome, but it was a beautiful book. I got a lot out of it, actually. Just the descriptions of what Afghanistan actually looks like during combat.
Huh. Well, I've been reading. That sounds neat. Sounds like a great event.
Good week, eh?
Yeah. I've been reading. I've been in a graphic novels phase, not surprisingly, after Toronto Comic Arts Festival. But right leading up to that, I'd read, finally, Blankets by Craig Thompson, one of the most known books of the genre, I think.
Yeah, some of the graphic novels out there right now have actually bridged that strange gap between comic book and, you know, traditional novel, and that's definitely one of them.
Yeah. And then I picked up this book at TCAF, Skyscrapers of the Midwest by Josh Cotter. And the story on this is, I'm certain that I made a note about it to myself at some point. I have no idea why or when, but as soon as I saw this book on the table, I knew that at some point I had wanted it for some reason. And it is a beautifully drawn, strange sort of fantastical story about two brothers, more about one than the other, and just, you know,
living life. And is your sense that this is a compendium of work over time,
or? This is fairly focused.
Okay.
I think it's four collected comic books, or four collected shorter books.
It's a gorgeous package.
It's so nice.
Yeah, Josh Cotter.
And the drawings are just beautiful.
So he draws
black and white pencil.
His characters are sort of cats, aren't they?
Cat human hybrids. Yeah, they're strange. Yeah, I'd say that's the best way to describe them. Cat humans.
Yeah. cool. Well, that was such an amazing festival, wasn't it?
That was nice. Next year, I definitely want more time there.
Peter and I rushed into Toronto and caught like the last window, the tiniest window at the end of the festival. But in a way, it was the best time to go.
Well, sort of. And we still left with probably about as much stuff yeah. as we would have wanted to.
We also bumped into our friends Dave and Miranda. And I think we kind of made a pact to, what did we each spend, like $100 or something, keep our cap at a certain. Or maybe we didn't.
I was aiming under that. I think I pulled it off, but yeah.
I actually emptied my wallet. Okay. It's such a great feeling. Like, I remember digging in the corners for pennies, you know, like, is there something's in there? There's a weird shape in the background.
So this costs $20. Is $9.04 okay?
Yeah. It's the end of the conference. You don't want to pack this up and take it home, do you?
Okay, well, we're lined up for an interview with Sarah Wheeler in just a couple minutes, so I'm going to go to a song. But once again, the recap. That was Sarah Wheeler. She's a fantastic nature and travel writer who most recently published The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle, starting in right on the eastern coast of, or in the northeast of Russia. She circumnavigated the Arctic Circle, going through Alaska and the Yukon, through to Greenland, Svalbard, and Lapland. And
having little adventures in each place.
Yeah, right? And documented the people who were finding work in those places, the people who are indigenous to those places, and also sort of urgently documenting the profound amount of evidence of
climate change,
very, very rapidly accelerating climate change,
yeah.
and sort of describing the Arctic as sort of the staging ground for a ton of change that's happening. It's the sink for all sorts of nasty chemicals and compounds, and it's the number one place to find evidence of a lot of things that are shifting.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating and beautiful and depressing book, and I'm excited to talk to her in a few minutes. Right here on Books for Breakfast on CFRU 93.3 FM in Guelph.
To CFRU Books for Breakfast, 93.3 FM in Guelph. And this is Dan Evans and your co-host Peter Bradley. And we're here today with guest Sarah Wheeler. Sarah, are you on the line?
I am.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, rather. Yeah. good to speak to you.
It's great to speak to you, too. I've been reading for a while. I've sort of drowsily been moving my way through The Magnetic North for a long time. I've found it, it's a book that really works well, read slowly. There's a lot to digest in there. Would you like to sort of describe what led you to write this? Previously, you'd written a book called Terra Incognita, Travels in Antarctica. But over the course of the last decade, you circumnavigated the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, what happened, Peter, was that the book you referred to, Terra Incognita, Travels in Antarctica, in fact, it was closer to two decades ago than I wrote that. And I was a young woman then, and Antarctica represented for me hope and a symbol of what the Earth could be, a sort of potential. It's the only unowned continent, and it was very clearly defined, and there's no people getting in the way of anything, and it was kind of pristine and perfect, and young authors should have hope. And it was a symbol of what, as I say, what everything could be. And I wasn't remotely interested in the Arctic, because it was all the opposite of all those things. Fragmented, nobody knew where it started or finished, everybody arguing about everything, a lot of disenfranchised peoples, sort of polluted and ghastly and problematic and horrible. So I wasn't interested, as I say, but the years went by. I wrote other books, did this and that, had my own children, became a middle-aged person. And as 50 approached, I started looking towards the Arctic, and just as the Antarctic had represented what the Earth could be, the Arctic seemed to me to represent what the Earth really is. And I think that in middle age, sort of suits that elegiac melancholy of middle age, that you want to deal with what's there rather than what could be. And I think if I've learned anything, it's that there is no answers. There's any questions, and the important thing is how to ask the questions. So I decided to go and have a look at the Arctic, and basically spent several years, as you say, circumnavigating, although in a very piecemeal fashion, and trying to spend some time in all the Arctic countries, of course, including Canada, having a look at what was going on there. And a lot of that meant being with the indigenous peoples and talking to them and so on, and just seeing what it was about, and trying to have a look at what the Arctic could teach us, and what the future might hold. And increasingly, of course, the Arctic has moved center stage with all its hydrocarbon potential for all the nations, not just Canada. And I think it's still very little known how that's going to play itself out. So I wanted to try and, in my book, The Magnetic North, paint a portrait of life above the Arctic Circle as it is for the people that live there, and what it represents to those of us in the lower latitudes.
It's by turns an incredibly gorgeous and incredibly depressing read. and there's not much hope offered through this. For the most part, you paint pictures of people whose ways of life have been changed, or of scientists who are sort of fighting to raise awareness of things that seem obvious, and you describe evidence of the Arctic being a drain for pollutants. Did you find much to be hopeful for there?
Yes, actually, bizarrely, I did. I think that it's an artist's responsibility always to find beauty amongst the horror, and you always can. And I find that both in people's indomitable spirit and also in the sort of redemptive beauty of the landscape. I wish, in a way, that the message of the book didn't come over in quite such a negative way, but I feel that one has to face the reality before one can start talking about things like redemption. In the case of the indigenous peoples, in Russia, for example, there's 17 Arctic polar peoples, completely separate, 17 different ones, all been dragged into the cash economy much more brutally than Canada has managed its own peoples, and become in the process disenfranchised and desperate. But whilst many of them succumb, not least to alcohol, others don't, and there is a spirit and a flame that is still alive and will always be alive, and I think that something will come of it. And even though I'm a grumpy old woman now, I still think you do have to have hope. And the landscape is incredibly beautiful all right across the Arctic. I mean, you don't need to speak to Canadians about the beauty of what you have. And I think that there's hope in what certain groups are doing. I mean, Greenpeace have got a fantastic initiative starting this June about the preservation with the cooperation of the indigenous peoples of certain sections of the Arctic Circle, and the whole question of ownership, who owns the seabed, which, as you know, is very topical in Canada, as in all the Arctic nations. And I think there's good forces at work to try and ensure that the people who have a smaller stake in the economy in the Arctic Circle are going to have more of a look in. So I think that in terms of the planet, I think that the Arctic will be fine, because the Earth always will be. It'll regulate itself as it always has. It's kind of us who's at stake, sort of lovable, ghastly humanity. And that's what I found, really, sort of lovable, ghastly humanity. And I think that if we, enough of us who are on the right side, work together to try and do the next right thing, then maybe it will be okay.
In the chapter that you dedicated to Greenland, well, you titled the chapter Beautiful Roots to Knowledge, after a scientist studying ages-old ice cores said to you, "I perceive the Arctic as a beautiful route to knowledge." Can you speak more to that idea?
Yes, certainly. I mean, the polar regions have always been at the cutting edge of climate science. And the stuff we read in our newspapers, you in Canada, me here in England, sort of watered down for public consumption about what's going on and there's going to be a great flood and we're all going to die, that comes from people sitting there over, I mean, I've done it myself, you sit there over an a hole in the ice for 6 hours, hauling out a load of tubes of stuff, measuring the temperature of the water flowing underneath it so you know how fast the glacier is moving. And that really is the cutting edge. And they're learning a lot of stuff. The trouble is that I'm not a scientist at all, but I've spent a lot of time with scientists in those environments, and the trouble is that actually it doesn't boil down largely to bite-sized chunks of information. And what I've learned is that the real clever scientists you talk to, any question you ask them, the first thing they say is, "Well, I don't know." And that's not very digestible or palatable by the media, but I think it's really important for people to understand that it is complicated, and all we're doing is just groping our way forward. And I think that the quote that you cite, Beautiful Roots to Knowledge, I thought it was a very wonderful thing how this scientist, who basically had spent years of his life sort of freezing almost to death and being separated from his family, measuring temperatures of what was going on underneath Greenland ice cap, understood that it was something incredibly important that was going to be understood, probably not by him, but by the next lot coming on and the next generation. And it's all a build-up of knowledge. And in a way, as somebody raised in the humanities, and as you know, our education system in the UK is incredibly specialised early on, much more so than yours. I think yours is much better in that people sort of study a lot of broader things, but we specialised really early on, so I just did masses of languages and I just read classics and all the rest of it. And I never really understood until I did sit over those ice holes how actually I think that artists and scientists are aiming for the same thing in the end, which is some kind of understanding of why we are here and what our stewardship should be and how we can maybe do something to make sure that we still are here in 10 generations' time. And that's what I think that Beautiful Roots to Knowledge is all about.
In Terra Incognita, one person that you spoke to sort of was trying to convince you to go out of your way to visit an ice stream that very few people had ever visited before. And he said, "Just come for the put-in. You must see it. I must support you as a writer." And it sort of made me wonder what you represent to as a travel and nature ecological writer to the scientists who you're working with or documenting.
Well, I'm glad you raised that guy, because he was quite a heroic figure, not just because he got me somewhere very unusual, but I think that in my experience, the enlightened scientists know that they're writing, obviously, for a very, very specific skilled field, and that nobody in a wider world like me would ever understand the specifics of what it is they're writing about. But there's something else beyond that, and they want to convey. And it's writers like me who are trying in our very primitive way to get messages out there. And if by taking them along, and I thought that whole thing, I'm glad you raised that, because it's a tiny thing in Terra Incognita, but it seemed to me in the true spirit of inquiry and of the continuation of knowledge, that that guy, who was a very distinguished scientist, thought it was worthwhile taking the extra trouble to have me there to tell people who weren't in his remit, because he was speaking to the, just the small circle of geochemists who knew what he was on about, to spread the word. And it seems to me that is a very enlightened thing. I have noticed more and more, actually, that people have writers in residence. There seems to be much more of an understanding now, some of an understanding, that writers do have a role in maybe conveying and mixing and somehow translating what scientists do to the public at large. And after all, you know, a lot of that science is funded by the taxpayer, so it's right and proper that the public should have some sort of access, but it needs to be purveyed, I think, in a way, in my small way. That's what I try and do, and I think I learned a lot about that kind of stuff in the polar regions and the work I've gone on to do subsequently. I try and carry it on. Of course, I think I'm incredibly privileged to have access, and I feel a responsibility to try and say to people who can get my books out of libraries and so on, you know, this is what's going on, what do you think, this is what I think, and here's an incredible story I learned about, you know, what it's like making a cup of tea at 80 below.
Speaking of tax-funded science in polar regions, you say at one point in the Canadian chapter of Magnetic North, one was inured to the irony of searching for more hydrocarbons when everyone knew they were contributing to the destruction of the Arctic. It was a kind of Emperor's New Clothes scenario. Nobody mentioned it. And I suppose there are sort of two types of scientists that you spend time with in this book. They're the people doing more general research, which often results in opportunities for mining and drilling. And then there are the scientists who are very sort of focused on the climate change type studies and the sort of broader understanding. That first type of scientist, can you speak more to sort of where they're coming from? And you say that nobody mentioned it, but I feel like that must have come up a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, it's not quite as... I mean, it's more porous than you indicate. I was with a bunch of Canadian scientists on Southampton Island who were spending taxpayers' money, and their information was going to be passed on to oil companies, as you know, have their own geologists, but those geologists can't afford to do the field work or don't have the manpower or the expertise or the knowledge to do the field work to sort of form the most, make the most basic maps of, okay, this looks like it might be a good place to start drilling. And so the Canadian government, like all other governments, gives them a leg up. And if you said that was a wrong thing, you'd be denying economic opportunities to all the disenfranchised poorer peoples who live farther north than you do. So I think it's important not to be judgmental. So these scientists whom your listeners are paying for are doing a sort of making basic geological maps so that oil companies can have an idea, and then it's their risk. It's the risk of the oil companies then to what happens when they start drilling, I say, or any sort of hydrocarbons or hard rock mining or whatever it is. And it's part of the economic ecosystem in which we live. And I think to start taking a high-minded moral view of saying that shouldn't be done would be to take all those peoples up there out of the economic ecosystem,
sure,
and say we're going to carry on doing what we're doing, and you can go hang. But by the way, don't eat anywhere else because we don't like you doing that either. So it's not straightforward. And I certainly have no moral judgment of the scientists who are innocently going around, you know, deploying their geological skills, identifying areas of the high Canadian Arctic where there might be stuff that's worth getting out, reporting that information, which then private companies are at their leisure to take up on or not. So I think it's not at all straightforward. I think that only it needs to be policed. But I think that, yeah, I think not being not judgmental is really important, and certainly to get on one's high horse and say only pure research, which is going to be published in learned journals, is worth doing, and you're a bad guy for taking the government dollar to find out stuff that's going to end up plundering. I just think that we've gone beyond all of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's too much. It's just not like that anymore.
Thanks. I suppose. Well, you've written these last two books, Terra Incognita and The Magnetic North. Before that, you explored Evia, a Greek island, and Chile. Are you, what is your focus pretty strictly on the polar climates at this point?
Not at all, no. Actually, I'm a generalist. I feel it's a terribly unfashionable thing to be a generalist, but I think someone's got to be one. And when The Magnetic North was published, the day The Magnetic North was published, I remember my eldest son saying to me, God, Mum, how do you feel today? You know, you spent so long on this book, so long in the polar regions, and, you know, what's your primary emotion? And I thought about it a lot, and I said to him, well, you know, really it's relief there's only two polar regions. And then he said, oh, you know what, Mum, they call Everest the third pole. I said, I really wish he hadn't said that. But I'm really interested in writing, Peter, about, you know, what it is to be human. And I've kind of, so I'm now working on other things. I'm writing a book, in fact, about, which will be published in Canada next year, about six middle-aged American English women writers who went to America in the middle of the 19th century.
Oh, wow.
Starting off with Fanny Trollope, who's Anthony's mother, and ending up with Jane Austen's niece. But it's kind of, you know, a lot of the same things in a way, what it is to be human and resolving the dilemmas of what that we all have and just fighting the fight to be truly oneself. So I'm pursuing the same type of things, but in other ways. And who knows, maybe I'll get back to the Arctic one day, but I think it's the kind of place that... whether it's the Russian Arctic, Canadian Arctic, anyway, it takes a lot of emotional investment, psychic investment, and I had something I wanted to say and find out, and having made that journey, now I have to wait till something comes around again. I'm trying always to say something that's remotely helpful to somebody, and we'll see what the future holds, but I'd love to go back to the Canadian Arctic. I'm married to a Canadian, so my children have Canadian citizenship. So I have a big sort of emotional investment in the country, and it's nice having kids who have that kind of Canadian experience in their DNA.
Thank you. At the start of the interview, you mentioned that that from the start, when you were sort of, maybe it was never a choice, but choosing between Antarctica and the Arctic 20 years ago, it was easy to go south. Because it even then seemed more pure, I suppose, and unblemished. I was wondering as I read The Magnetic North, if how your writing about Antarctica would be different now than it was then. Have you been back at all?
I haven't, no. I think that's a really hard question you asked me, Peter, because it's like, it would be like me saying to you, how would it be if you went out with a girlfriend that you had 30 years ago,
yeah,
now? I mean, you're not, you know, you're not the you were then. So I think it would be completely different, and my interests would have been different. And I think that, yeah, I think I was looking for answers then. I think that I saw that landscape as a young woman with hope and idealism, and sort of one feels one didn't know very much, which is good. I mean, it's good not knowing very much. It's good being young and idealistic and hopeful and all the rest of it. I've never been back to the Antarctic, and the reason really for that is I said it was a difficult thing to go to the Arctic and costs a lot sort of emotionally and psychically, but going to the Antarctic is a kind of huge thing from every single point of view, practically, emotionally. I mean, it's just a big commitment, and when I went there last time I felt I had something to say and something that would be useful and sort of a mission, if you like, to use a rather elevated word. And so I can't imagine ever going back unless I felt that again. I don't know what that will be, but maybe something will come again. I'd want to have something to contribute. It's not somewhere you can just go and swan around. And it was a massive part of my life for at least 3 years. I was there for 7 months in the Antarctic, but it was at least 3 years, probably 4 years, once I came to writing the book as well. So it's a big sort of chunk of one's life to dedicate.
Definitely.
And as I say, there was a reason to do it. I wanted to say something about what the Antarctic was and how important it was to preserve it and this and that. So I think until that comes again, I won't go back. I get asked all the time to go and lecture on cruise ships and that kind of thing, which of course would be jolly enjoyable from one point of view, but somehow or other I can't do it unless there's a real reason for it. But I think that one couldn't ask a writer, how could you write that book again now, because one's not the same person. I look back at the young woman who wrote all the books of my younger days, and I sort of dimly recognize her as me, which is good. I mean, one has to evolve. A writer couldn't be a writer if you're the same person throughout. I hope that answers the question, does it?
Yeah. The reason I asked that question was more about the urgency around climate change that permeates the magnetic north.
I see what you mean. Yeah, it's astonishing, isn't it, how even 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I was in the Antarctic, climate change was not the top story. It was there, but it was not the top story. So I think you're right that were one to go back to the Antarctic now, it would be almost dishonest as a writer not to bring that to the top of the agenda. And I think it would be hard not to do anything as a writer except be very focused on talking to the guys, as I've said, spooling down those tubes and finding out what was going on. But I think that to do that, I mean, there's a difference between me and a science writer. There's masses of fantastic science writers out there who, that's what they do, they write about science. And they're doing that job, and my role, I feel, is to do something else. So I think it probably would be difficult to go back there now to the Antarctic and to achieve that balance between not pretending I'm a science writer because other people have got the expertise to do that I haven't, and also not possibly being able to ignore the fact that this has moved way up the agenda and is the issue of our time. It's interesting, having done a lot of work on Captain Scott and so on, particularly this year, the centenary, seeing how very similar it is to what was the top issue of their era, which is, of course, evolution, and finding the missing link. And that's partly why it was such a big thing to go and collect the eggs of the emperor penguin and so on and so on and so on. And they talked about Darwin and evolution all the time, and Captain Scott had a copy of The Origin of Species and its Natural Selection in his sleeping bag, and it was just a huge issue, and it was like the grail and so on and so on. And it's very comparable to our own day that, this is the top story and we have to find out because it's our own species at stake.
Indeed. I would hate for the listener to come away from this interview thinking that The Magnetic North is strictly a book about climate change. You do an incredible job of sprinkling the travel and nature and ecological writing with anthropology and tons of history and all sorts of cultural context. And also a lot of sort of personal anecdotal stuff that's lots of fun to read. And it's a real treat to talk to you, and your writing is wonderful. Thank you very much for joining us on Books for Breakfast today.
It's a pleasure.
Have a great day.
And you.
Bye. Oh, that was great.
That was wonderful.
I'm really glad to have had a chance to talk to Sarah Wheeler about her excellent little nugget of so-called travel writing, The Magnetic North.
I don't mean to denigrate the genre, but it seems bigger than a travel writing book, doesn't it?
Well, I think a good travel writing book always seems bigger than a travel writing book.
That's true.
As I mentioned at the end there, it is not the mood it leaves you with is, or the mood it's left me with is a bit despairing, but that's not how it's written so much.
She's more interested in sort of touring through some of the cultures and geographies that are
and the history that she presents in it is wonderful, and that is not history that you ever hear about anywhere.
No.
The history of northern people outside of, like, we hardly get the history of northern Canadians. We certainly don't get the history of other northern cultures.
Imagine them, you know. I would have listened to you talk to her for another hour, because it would be neat to get into, you know, the questions of, you know, what we hear about is a lot of legal issues. So how are we dividing the waters, you know, among the nations of the North? Mm-hmm. But those have very real ramifications in things like, where are the port towns cropping up? Like, if this is going to be a major seaway, a thoroughfare for a lot of shipping, say, for example, then of course there are going to be towns that crop up. Mm-hmm. That's how civilization grew, right? Shipping routes, cities growing on shipping routes, mm-hmm. turned into massive nations, you know? And so where are these... What is the geography like up there? Like, now that the ice has melted off the land and ships are going to be coming through.
Yeah, she rightly sort of scolded me for the tone of my question about the scientists whose work is very well lent to oil and mining companies. But that sort of does zero in on sort of a central thread throughout this book and throughout northern cultures in general, which is that intrusions have always and continue to come with damage, even when the intrusions are well intended.
Right. But it's hard to see any sort of hydrocarbon work as primarily well intended.
Yeah. There's a line that cropped up in the book. I think in this case she was talking about nagging pollutants that just travel up the food chain and never disappear. I think they're called POPs.
Okay. Cool.
And
like mercury, I guess.
Yep. But she used the line, "Another poisonous legacy of well-intentioned technological innovation." and that was sort of what I was trying to get at with that question. How are people doing their work in the North dealing with the knowledge that there's a really sinister side
underpinning everything
trying to do with good intent.
So is this is the Magnetic North a good place for people to start if they want to read a little bit of Sarah's work?
I think definitely, yeah. It's very timely. It leaves you with a lot to think about. I've found that it does. It's divided chapter by chapter by the countries that she visits along the way, and it starts on the eastern coast of Russia, and then travels through Alaska and Canada and east around the world from there. I find the way that I have been reading it is over the course of a long, long time, slowly digesting chunks. And
as if you're traveling.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually walking from country to country.
Yeah. And so I would definitely recommend this one for people to sort of leaf through over a while, because it will leave you with a lot. So that's The Magnetic North by Sarah Wheeler. It's available through Farrar, Straus and Giroux. I think you should be able to find it fairly readily.
Yeah, it's a 2010, right? So it's still on bookshelves. And the other book Peter was mentioning was her earlier book from the 90s, so it might not be as easy to find, but it's worth something.
That's Terra Incognita, Travels in Antarctica.
Yeah, that was a great interview. Thanks for doing that. I loved how she's delicate, very delicate, and, you know, very careful with her words. Excellent speaker as well as writer, but I loved when she was talking about her sons carrying mm-hmm. Canadian DNA and
and they both crop up in here as well. She brought her older son along in one of these chapters on a boat trip across the Arctic Ocean.
Hmm. So if you were facing this choice, she kind of set us up. There is an ecological imperative in both poles, or what, two of three poles. I had never heard that before, that Everest was the third pole. That's cool. But where would you go if you were going first? Which
oh,
way?
My goodness.
North or south?
I think I actually saw at some point a job posting. It was the strangest thing, and I don't know how it ended up. It might have been something that went viral.
Was it a dream?
I don't think it was a dream. It could have been, but I think I saw it on some internet conglomerizer, a job posting to be a cook at one of these Arctic, or I don't even remember where it was. It could well have been a dream. Yeah, but I
know someone who did that.
I love the idea of that because it. I mean, she mentions in Terra Incognita that the cooks are the most steady human component of these bases. They are the ones that are there for years at a time, and who see everyone come and go. And I just feel like that would be the most incredible job. But I don't know. I'm not sure where I would go first. I think there's not exactly... there just aren't amenities in Antarctica, so I think I'll go north first.
Yeah, no, I think
and
you're
I
right.
Am, well,
you
sort of.
You saw the Werner Herzog documentary, I think. Is it Close Encounters at the Edge of the World or something to that effect? Mm-hmm. And that shows you the one major base camp in the Antarctic,
yeah.
And it's got quite a few. Remember, they had a flourishing greenhouse. It was incredible. They were mm-hmm. growing their own tomatoes in a hothouse. But outside of that, there's zero.
Yeah.
There's nothing.
Huh. It's all, well, magnetic for me. I'm super interested in this stuff.
I thought you were going to bring that pun up. It is an apt pun, and
it's know. Actually a fantastic title in terms of a lot, like all of the things that the North attracts in terms of, as I said, pollutants and well, the author.
Yeah, but, human interest.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Cool. Anyhow, yeah, really nice to have a chance to talk to Sarah Wheeler. I definitely recommend that book. But I guess that just about wraps it up. So let's cue some outro music.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say that last week we had Anna Kana on the show, Anna Kana Schofield. That was great. And the Biblioasis reading came off really well this Monday. And boy, I really hope people follow up with that press.
That was a neat reading. And seeing those tables stocked with Biblioasis books... They're doing good stuff.
Dan Wells and Biblioasis have made a really beautiful list, so do check out their website, and we're going to have Dan Wells on the show again in the future.
But before that, we're going to have John Jeremiah Sullivan on the show next week.
That's exciting.
Author of Pulphead, a collection of essays that have appeared here and there and everywhere. He's like Chuck Klosterman without the meanness, I think is my pocket summary of him at this point.
Okay.
He's like a nice Chuck Klosterman, which is refreshing.
So smart, open, culturally attuned.
Yeah. And it's actually a bad description because the two aren't similar at all. Sullivan isn't trying to offer you answers or opinions.
No.
He's sort of offering the story straight. So he's much more classic than Klosterman.
But he does frame a lot of his experiences through the lens of himself. The writer has
That's
Klosterman.
True. Excited to talk to him next
Me week. Too.
That should be great.
Thanks for lining that up.
I think that's another one through for our Stress and Drew.
And and thanks for listening. And so do tune in next week. You'll like this guy even if you haven't had a chance to read his stuff yet.
Yeah. Thanks for listening again. Another week to Books for Breakfast. Oh, you know what's new? We have a website now. booksradio.com is where you can go to catch up on the last few episodes of the show. And we'll be stocking that with more finely honed entries soon.